Hi, and welcome to episode number 164 of the weekly Google Cloud Platform podcast. My name is Mark Mandel, and this week I am very excited to be joined by the wonderful John Faust. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing good. Pleasure to be on the podcast for the first time.
Oh, awesome. So glad to have you here. For people who don't know you, do you want to give people a quick intro into who you are and what you do at Google?
Sure. So my name is John Faust. I am a developer advocate specializing in cloud gaming. I mainly focus on a lot of the GCP Unity integrations and helping out with the Connected Games initiative that Google and Unity have together.
Awesome. Fantastic. So this week, I'm also excited to have another wonderful person coming to join us. Miles Borins is coming back to talk to us about Node.js. He last talked to us back in 2017. I actually went and had a look. So I think there's probably some new and exciting things in that. And then after that, we have our question of the week where I get to ask you tough questions, John, about the work you've been doing, connecting Google Cloud APIs and working within Unity and how you do that.
It'll be fun.
It'll be fun. But why don't we get stuck into some cool things of the week before we get stuck into those other topics? My favorite cool thing of the week this week is that Google Cloud Next 19's session guide is now available. So if you're familiar with Cloud Next, it's our big flagship conference here in San Francisco. It's big, it's bright, it's beautiful. And we do a lot of talks about all the things cloud. So if you want to see what some of the sessions are, we have hundreds and hundreds of sessions across infrastructure, application development, data management, analytics and intelligence, productivity and collaboration. Oh my God, so much stuff.
It's a mouthful.
So if you want to check that out. Yeah, it's a lot. But there's hundreds of topics. So check it out and see what's going on. John, what have you got?
Sure. So we're introducing schedule snapshots for Compute Engine persistent disk. So what it means is that we have schedule automated snapshots on any time interval of your liking.
Oh, cool.
So this means that you can do every 6 hours or every Monday. And also what you can do is we have schedule retention policies as well. So that means you can actually set it to actually delete those snapshots every 6 hours, every Monday, or every month.
Oh, that's super cool. That's really nice. Speaking of doing regular things to Compute Engine's instances, there's a new solution that came out called Reliable Task Scheduling on Compute Engine with Cloud Scheduler. So Cloud Scheduler is the thing we brought out, I think it was several months ago now, for doing reliable, basically cron scheduling for items. And there's a solution here with code that talks about how you can use Cloud Scheduler sending data to PubSub on a regular basis, say like on a cron, basically, and then reliably parsing that or doing something or some sort of operation on GCE with that and making sure that it works in a reliable way, even if some of your instances go down or other things like that. So if you're looking to do something along those sort of lines, you can check out that blog post. It's got diagrams and code and all sorts of other good stuff too.
Another cool thing that we have going on is one of our teammates posted a blog post, how to make a self-destructing VM on Google Cloud.
Oh, cool.
What that actually does for you is like, suppose that you have a VM that's been running for a while and you forget about it and you don't really want to pay for it, you can actually have a startup script that actually, once you've started your VM, automatically starts a countdown for deletion. So you can set it for 2 hours, a week or so. It's pretty awesome.
This message will self-destruct as soon as you read it or something like that.
Exactly. After reading the blog post, I felt like a GCP spy.
That's fantastic. Last but not least, we have a new blog post that's come out talking about our AI-powered speech, giving it more options, lower prices, new languages and voices. So if you're looking to do sort of text-to-speech type operations, now we have support for 7 new languages, including Danish, Portuguese and Portugal, Russian, Polish, Slovakian, Ukrainian and Norwegian, and Bokmål, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. There's also 31 new voices, all sorts of good stuff. So there's now a total of 21 languages and variants, 111 total voices, and 57 WaveNet voices as well. Whew. So if you're looking to create speech from text, you may want to check out some of those new features that we have available.
Definitely going to build some cool things with that.
I bet you will. Awesome. Why don't we chat with Miles and go see what's going on in Node.js land? As always, I am extremely excited to have another of my favorite people joining us on the podcast today. Miles Borins is coming to talk to us about Node.js. Miles, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Yesterday was my birthday. And
happy birthday!
We had a lot of fun and I'm in, you know, relatively high spirits and feeling quite positive today.
Yeah, it was definitely a fun time. I actually got to celebrate with Miles last night.
Well, happy birthday, Miles. Happy birthday indeed.
Yeah.
Is this coming on the podcast your birthday present? Is that basically how this works?
You know, I didn't want to put too much pressure on you, but it's the highlight of my day after my birthday.
Excellent. Excellent. So I know this isn't your first time on the podcast. We did have you back in 2017 for episode 105. But if people haven't had the distinct pleasure of meeting you, do you want to tell us about who you are and what you do at Google?
I'm a developer advocate at Google, working specifically on Google Cloud Platform and more specifically in our languages team. I actually think we all report up through the same manager. That's fun.
I think we actually do. That's really fun.
This could be like our weekly stand-up as well. Within languages, I focus on Node.js, and I do quite a bit of work with our various runtime teams. So that's Cloud Functions, App Engine, Serverless Containers. More recently, like in the last couple of weeks, I've started digging into Cloud Build quite a bit. When I'm not, you know, working directly at Google, I do a lot of open source work. I sit on the technical steering committee of the Node.js project, and I represent the steering committee on the board of directors of the foundation. I also do standards work at TC39, and I've started to do some work at W3C and IETF as well.
So not a lot, just a couple of things.
Yeah, just a few things.
Yeah, and you forgot that you are very engaged in the community, especially meetups that involve food.
Yeah, that's true. I do run DimSum.js.
I did not know that was a thing, but now I want to go that is a thing.
I used to run the San Francisco one.
Excellent. Awesome. So yeah, we did have you back in 2017 talking about all the Node.js things, but it's been a year or so. So what's changed? I'm sure there's stuff.
There's a couple different things. One of the things that's fairly new and I wanted to plug that I'm excited about is Node.js.dev. So Google has very recently launched the .dev top-level domain, and is part of launching the domain, which has a number of stages of access. So if you really, really cared about getting a domain, you know, you could have gotten a couple days ago for $11,000. I think it's now like $1,100. And by, I think it's Monday, it gets down to about $150. So I have a reminder set for Monday. Hopefully I can get a couple I have on my mind a little cheaper. But it goes all the way down to $15 will be regular registration. But a number of different partners, as well as individuals who own IP rights, got early access to domains. And one of those was Node.js.dev. The .dev team reached out to myself and Franziska Hinkelman, who is another DevRel or who focuses on Node.js, asking if we'd be interested in using it for the foundation. And in 6 weeks of a sprint, we put together a static Gatsby website. It is based on a whole bunch of content that the project's been working on for a while. It's a whole new slew of getting started documentation about, hey, how do I get started with Node? What are some of the basic concepts? How do I even do a Node? And so it's a really great starting place for people who want to learn about Node.js. It's also an open source project that's available on github.com/Node.js/Node.js.dev. So if you're looking for kind of a low barrier way to get started in contributing to the Node.js project, if you like React, if you like Gatsby, if you like playing around with websites and improving SEO, there's lots of different ways where you can come in and get involved.
Nice. What can we actually expect to see on Node.js.dev, like the landing page?
So there's actually a bit of a history to the content that ended up there, which I think is kind of fun. So we have the current Node.js.org website, and that has been around for a number of years. It's showing its age a bit. And I think around a year to a year and a half ago, working groups spun up around a website redesign. And they've been doing this like super extensive redesign of the whole site. And as you can imagine, when you decide to just completely replace something instead of just doing iterative change, it takes a long time to make something that's feature complete or to build consensus around the features that you're going to drop. One of the things that that team worked on was this large slew of content. There was a collaborator who, their name is escaping me right now, but I'll dig it up and hand it over to both of you so we can include it in the liner notes.
Awesome.
But someone wrote all this amazing content and donated it to the website redesign group, and it was to live on the /learn page on that new site. And when we found out that we were going to get the .dev TLD, one of the first things we need to figure out was, okay, well, what content are we going to even put there? And it quickly came up as like, hey, actually, we have all these wireframes for the new redesigned website, including this one learn page. And we have 70 to 100 pages of documentation. Why don't we just do that? And so we actually just made what was originally supposed to be a single route on the new page into this one kind of specific landing page. And it's possible that we may just slowly kind of bootstrap more and more features onto this page, and it could eventually become the new Node.js landing page altogether, but it may continue to just be its own separate learning resource page. But John, to more explicitly answer your question, all of this is very much up in the air, and it's going to be very much determined by who's showing up and who's doing the work, what work actually gets done, what kind of consensus we can build around it. But, you know, the future is open. It can be whatever the people who are working on it make it into.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it looks like all the content is all available on GitHub. So you want to go and edit it, you can go play with it all on there if you want to add or edit and do stuff to it.
Yeah, and we actually just added today at the bottom of the page is just an edit on GitHub button, which will drop you right into the GitHub editor. And so it's all just markdown. So if you see a spelling mistake, just scroll down to the bottom of the page, click that button. You could send us a PR.
Awesome.
Excellent. And I think you were talking earlier and you said there was some cloud build integration or something like that. You did some GCP integration there. What's that all about?
Yeah. So for those who don't know, Cloud Build is a product from GCP. I have been very recently, as of like yesterday when I had an aha moment, referring to it as like serverless ops. Mm-hmm. But it's a really cool product where like with a YAML file, you can describe, hey, like here's a container and then run this command with the container and set a series of steps. You can then connect Cloud Build to a particular repo, and then you can trigger particular YAML files, like describe builds or Docker files on specific actions. And those can either be pushes to specific branches, the creation of tags, or on pull requests. And you can create regular expressions to filter them all as well. So you could be like, hey, if a branch is pushed that matches this. So like, for example, one of the things that we do is deploy to Firebase Hosting on a push to master. So it auto deploys with continuous integration.
Oh, nice.
And then the other one that we have is build and push to staging on a pull request. But one of the things that Cloud Build has that's kind of interesting is we have it set up so that it doesn't run automatically when a pull request is opened. A collaborator actually has to put in a special comment and that will trigger the build.
Oh, I see.
And the reason for that is what gets kind of neat with this is internally in the IAM roles inside of Google Cloud, you can set specific IAM roles to the build agent itself. So for example, I'm using Cloud Build to deploy to Firebase and all I had to do was deploy a new image that is meant to deploy with the Firebase API. And then I gave Cloud Build itself IAM admin privileges over Firebase. And now whenever it runs that script, all of the credentials that are necessary are already inlined. So I don't need to inline any credentials and I can restrict or add more privileges based on what the need are. But this is part of the reason to have it so that for running the build, you need to have a comment from a collaborator. Mm-hmm. We went back and forth on this quite a bit, but it could be like a resource attack. If you just automatically kicked it off and then someone could just like shimmy in a Bitcoin miner, which you don't want happening.
Ooh, so that's really interesting. How have you got the integration set up between the GitHub page itself and writing a comment there and then like firing off a build on Cloud Build? Because they're not like hooked up that way.
So this is just built into Cloud Build actually. So with Cloud Build, there's a new thing that's rolling out publicly soon where you essentially click a button to link the repo. It links the pull request and using GitHub's event-based API, it actually triggers an event which we handle internally on every comment. So it's actually just a box you tick when you're setting up the pull request trigger that just says, do not run this trigger unless someone explicitly runs it. So we actually kind of have two different things going on right now. We have like one check suite where Travis runs and Travis will run the build, Travis will run the test suite, and it will let us know if anything's broken. And then we can trigger this other build through Cloud Build. And what it will do is it compiles the site, it builds it, we have a single folder, then it uploads that to GCS using the SHA of the commit as kind of the slug for it. And then it puts a comment in that says, hey, go to this link and you'll have a staging version of the site.
Nice.
This just makes it really easy for people when they send PRs. We can kick off a build once we reviewed it and see that there's nothing nefarious going on. And at that point, we have a link that anyone can go to and look at so people can review it even like on mobile. You never have to really like have an environment set up to review it.
Yeah, it's awesome.
That's super nice. Actually, it sounds like Cloud Build and GitHub integration improved since I last looked at it.
Yeah, and it's been really fun digging into this as well because there's all sorts of unexpected edge cases that I've been encountering, and it's been really great working with the Cloud Build team. They've been super responsive, and they're really interested in making a best-in-class integration here, so it's been really fun.
Awesome. I know you do a lot of stuff as well on the Node.js Foundation side as well. There's been some interesting foundational work that seems to have been going on recently. You want to tell us about what's happening there?
I like how you called it. It's foundational. So the Node.js Foundation is a nonprofit. It's a 501c6. And, you know, it has kind of this mission of sponsoring, overseeing the Node.js project and the work towards it. There's another foundation in the ecosystem focused on JavaScript called the JSF. It's the JS Foundation. And they are actually both under the Linux Foundation as kind of like where they were brought up. And for a number of different reasons, including, hey, there's two things, which one do I support financially? We found that it was in the best interest of all of the projects to look into merging the two foundations. So last October, we announced at Node Interactive that we had an intent to merge the Node.js Foundation and the JSF into one umbrella organization. Some of the biggest differences for the Node.js Foundation itself was that there are more than one projects in it. Actually, Express and libuv are under the Node.js Foundation as well. It was mostly built up to support a single project. And the top-level governance of that project, the Technical Steering Committee, was chartered direct from the board to oversee kind of everything in the open source side of things. There's a strong separation. And I think we dug into this in our last podcast, but there's a really strong separation between the technical governance and kind of community governance and the financial governance. So the board oversees finances. They oversee certain degrees of marketing. But the board is unable to tell like Node Foundation, like, hey, put this person on your committee or hey, land this PR. We have a community governance process that's set up. We're openly governed, and that's how things run. And so one of the interesting challenges here is the JSF has, I think, like 15 or 20 projects. I should know that number. I don't know it offhand.
Give or take.
Yeah, give or take.
10%.
But in the merger, we now are going to have a structure where we need to support many projects. And so since October, we have been holding weekly open public meetings. We've been broadcasting them on YouTube, and they're all saved. And there's meeting notes for all of them that are on a GitHub repo, github.com/node.js/bootstrap. And this bootstrap committee has been designing the governance for the new foundation. It started with a couple weeks of actually designing the governance for the committee so we could design the governance for the foundation. And once we reached consensus on a process, it actually, in a really amazing way, unlocked this thing we had never really considered before, where the foundation itself, we never really had a process for how collaborators could come up with new processes or new committees or new initiatives that they wanted to run within the foundation. So the first thing we did was actually design this process. It's a proposal process. It's based on how TC39 designs the JavaScript language, but there's three phases. Technically four if you consider stage zero, but it's like, hey, here's an idea of something we want to do is stage zero. Stage one is, hey, here's a rough shape of how we want to do it. To get to stage two, you need to actually have all the documentation put together and agreed upon by the community that, hey, this is exactly how we want to run it. And at stage two, it goes to the board or to whatever committee will oversee it to approve that, hey, we agree with this. And then it moves to stage three, which means it's initiated. So moving forward, the foundation will actually have a whole thing in place for people who want to do new things with it. The foundation is being designed with a top-level committee known as the Cross Project Council. There'll be representatives from various different projects within the foundation itself on that committee. And that committee will be chartered by the board to oversee chartering other projects, managing budget, code of conduct escalations. We're actually looking at having a foundation-wide code of conduct. And it's going to be interesting finding the balance, because in the same way that we kept a clear separation between the board and the technical project and the Node Foundation, we want to still maintain a pretty clear separation between the Cross Project Council and the technical projects. We don't want the foundation itself dictating too directly how projects should be run. But with that being said, we're pretty opinionated about what it means to be openly governed and what makes healthy, active projects. So there are things that will be necessary, but we're trying to find the balance there. So like, you will have to have a license. It may have to be within a subset of licenses, but we're not going to be like, you must have the Apache license, but it will be like, hey, you must have like Apache or MIT or GPL that doesn't start with the letter A or like some combination of that. We're also going to have strict code of conduct that all of the projects must adopt. But then that introduces interesting problems. Like if a project only has 10 or 15 people, how do we actually help them maintain and enforce that code of conduct if they don't have the resources to do so? So we're looking at spinning up foundation-wide committees to help with that. And there'll be a number of different places where projects can come in different progression. So like, for example, right now when we were doing the merger, the libuv project, and that's kind of the underlying abstraction of system calls that's used in Node, that project is healthy and active, but don't have any interest in working with higher level governance or getting any sort of marketing support or larger financial support. They just want to like keep the lights on and have infrastructure support. So we have a way that they can come into the new foundation. There's no expectation of them having to grow to do anything more. It's a vendor neutral place for them to keep their IP. It's somewhere for them to receive the small amount of resources that they need and to just kind of do their thing. And they'll still be empowered to come, like any member of any project in the foundation will be able to attend CPC meetings and be able to participate in consensus at the CPC. But there will be a smaller subset of voting members that represent the impact level projects, which is kind of like our top level. I mentioned all these different things you need to be in the foundation. There'll be even kind of more guidelines for projects that were considered impact level that will have more support and from the foundation itself. I think I spiraled out there. there's lots of stuff. So I guess like in short, you know, check out that Bootstrap repo. All of the governance has been designed using that proposal process that I was talking about. All the proposals are documented in there. And you can read them. You can see the history of how we got where we are. And if you are a member of any of the projects that are involved in the foundation, you're encouraged to open a PR and start engaging and changing it. Show up to any of the meetings and participate. We're trying to minimize the amount of hierarchy, but create enough structure to empower people to, you know, enact the change they want to see.
We've actually shared a cab ride, and I remember you giving me the less long-winded version of this, and I can tell that you're pretty excited about it.
And this version is still pretty abridged, too. We could probably do like a two-hour podcast of me talking just about this.
Oh, my God.
Definitely. But Miles, I'm curious, what does this actually mean for developers?
Foundations can often be like a release team. It's like one of those things that you don't notice until you need it. And generally when it's in a place that really is like, oh my God, I'm so glad I have this in place, it's usually too late. Like if you didn't have it. A good thing for developers would be like any of the projects that are inside of this foundation, they should know that resources, oversight, and initiatives are in place to help support that project and make sure that that project is healthy. Arguably, if any of the projects within the foundation are not doing well, that reflects poorly on the foundation and the cross-project council itself. So I think that there is a certain amount of comfort that people could have in knowing that the projects are going to be maintained. The other side, too, is if you're a developer working for a company and that company maybe has stringent open source policies, or alternatively, if you want to be collaborating on something, in general, having the IP of an open source project in a neutral body that's a nonprofit significantly helps organizations collaborate together on these things. So like Node.js being inside of this nonprofit in this vendor neutral place to store everything, that allows companies like Google and Microsoft and IBM and Intel all to come together and collaborate. And I know at least, you know, from personal experience that some of the organizations that I mentioned would not like put an entire headcount or multiple headcount onto a project if it was owned by a competitor. That's just not smart business. So I think also as a developer, it helps you to maybe contribute back depending on the company that you work for and their policies.
Nice. Awesome.
Nice. What news have we got about Node.js on Google Cloud Platform? Have we had any recent updates or cool things that have come out that you want to talk about as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a couple different places where you can run Node in our cloud.
Yeah, maybe give people a reminder of where you can run Node in our cloud. That's probably a good starting point.
One of the obvious ones, like, you know, kind of the old school way of running code in Google Cloud is App Engine. And so we've got both App Engine Flex and App Engine Standard support for Node.js. We currently support the Node.js 8 runtime in general availability, and the Node 10 runtime is beta. But I do believe that we're going to be moving 10 to general availability in short order. I don't have an explicit timeline on it, but sooner rather than later might be a nice way of putting it.
That works.
For cloud functions, we support Node.js. We support Node.js in version 6 and 8. Both of those are in general availability. And in a similar short order, we're looking at bringing out the Node.js 10 runtime in beta on cloud functions. We also have this thing that's being worked on. It's kind of secret, but not super secret, because I know I can tweet the sign-up link. But we have this thing that we've been working on called serverless containers. And that's totally a place that you can run Node as well. I mean, arguably, you can run anything that's in a Docker container that responds to something on port 80. But, you know, it is a cool place to put Node. And like one of the ways I like to think about it, too, is like all of these are kind of abstractions on themselves. And I think something that we're working towards and trying to get out in the Node 10 runtime for Cloud Functions is like this idea that there really isn't that much different between a container, an app, and a function. And, you know, a function itself is built with containers and it just has an opinionated way of running the code. It looks a lot like Express, but it's a little framework that's built on top of Node to make it easier to run your code. So if you're writing code inside of a function and then you kind of hit this boundary of like, hey, you know, working within this one function isn't really giving me all the flexibility and expressiveness that I need, you can easily take that and turn it into an app and then deploy it to App Engine and see, you know, similar billing or similar functionality. Also, maybe better cold start times, depending on what you're doing. But if you hit the edge of like, hey, this is like the edge of what I can do with App Engine standard, which is going to have faster deploy times and it's more managed, you can move to Flex or to serverless containers and start using a Docker container. If maybe there's a native module that we don't support, or there's something that you need to do, like spinning up a certain binary or anything fancy that goes beyond what we offer in our base image. One of the things that I find really empowering and important to think about is like, there are containers all the way down, all of these things. And so it's kind of just like, how much sugar do you want in your cereal? And how much do you want things to be on rails? I don't know. I can come up with some more idioms.
Sugar in your cereal is awesome.
But really, at the end of the day, I guess functions also have the advantage of eventing right now. So you can take like some event and tie it to a function. So it's really easy to like have something that puts a whole bunch of things in a task queue that triggers a pub sub and then triggers a function in the background. I like using these for things like emailers or for transcoding or stuff like that. But overall, all of these different things have their uses, and we can kind of grow with you depending on what you're doing, how you're doing it, and what you need to do.
Yeah, sure. So, Miles, what other places can we actually, you know, run JavaScript?
So, there are a handful of other places you can run JavaScript in Google Cloud that's really fun, and maybe you wouldn't think about it. You can run JavaScript inside of any G Suite products with AppScript. AppScript is JavaScript, and there's like a new beta that you can use to try it out with the new V8 engine. So, if you've ever written functions to, you know, like edit your spreadsheets, I'm actually using it right now. We're managing a guest list for a large event that we're planning. And there were like some queries that we want to do that I couldn't figure out how to do that inside of Sheets. So I actually just wrote a little script and it did it in a really nice way. You can also write user-defined functions inside of BigQuery. So you can write JavaScript inside of BigQuery in case, you know, your JavaScript skills are a little bit better than your SQL skills. Another one that you can do there that I find super fun is like if you're doing anything with parsing JSON, it's like way easier to parse and manipulate JSON with JavaScript than it is with SQL. So you can write, you know, like little query functions to do that.
I don't know Node very well. And we're talking about different Node versions. Like you said, AppScript is moving to like the V8 runtime. And like on App Engine, it was moving from like 8 to 10 or something. Like, why would I want to change the different versions of Node that I'd be using? Like, why do I care as a developer?
One thing I could advise to people who are listening, if they want to learn more about this, there's a talk that I gave called The Hilarious Misadventures of Being a Platform Downstream from Your Language. That kind of digs into this a little bit. But the shorter version is Node kind of conflates the concept of an API and a runtime, and it embeds something called V8. So V8 is the JavaScript engine from the Chrome browser. It's part of the Chromium project. It's its own open source project. And V8 gets embedded in a whole bunch of different places. So when we're talking about like AppScript, the new version is based on V8. When we're talking about those like user-defined function stuff, V8 is what's executing the JavaScript. So V8 is a JavaScript virtual machine, and it gets embedded in different places, Chromium being one of them, Node being one of them. We embed V8. When we execute your JavaScript code, we're handing it off to that VM, and it's executing it and doing stuff with it. But with Node, it executes your code, but it's not just executing arbitrary JavaScript, it's executing it with very specific semantics. Like when you use require, for example, that is a nodeism. That's an API that we created for module loading. And when you use something like FS, that's not like this standardized API for file system work that runs everywhere. It is a node-specific API. So Node itself is that combination of a runtime and an API surface. And when we talk about the different versions, like Node 8 versus Node 10, one of the biggest and most obvious differences is that 10 has a newer version of V8 in it.
Gotcha.
Because it came out later. And us updating V8 is a Semver major change for all sorts of different reasons. I gave another talk called Node.js Versions, How Do They Work, which kind of digs into that. But essentially, it's a breaking change for us to upgrade V8 inside of Node. So when you're on an older version of Node, like Node 8, you're using an older version of the virtual machine. So it may not have all the same language features. I think like one of the ones that's in 10 that isn't in 8 is like array.includes maybe. There's a couple of them. Mm. The JavaScript language is standardized and there's new features added on a yearly basis. So a new version of Node is likely to have new features. Like Node 8, for example, introduced async await, which is a new way of handling asynchronicity, which I can bubble about for a long time. But Node 10, for example, comes with a whole bunch of optimizations to async await. So the same async await code will run like 20% faster in Node 10 than in Node 8, because when it came out in Node 8, it was still a relatively new feature. That's the different versions of Node, but then there's also all those different versions of V8, which introduce the new features. And when we upgrade V8 in Node, we get those new features in Node, which then in turn requires us to like update some of our APIs to reflect that. So we're in the process, for example, of introducing a whole bunch of new promise-based APIs, because most of our APIs are traditionally callback-based and more specifically Node callback-based, which is a very specific way of writing callback code. But if you want to use async await, you want promises. So like, for example, in Node 8, we had this new API called util.promisify. So you could take any API that was written using a callback-based API, we turn it into a promise-based API for you. But one of the things that we can do as a runtime, because we're directly interfacing with V8, is we can call like the underlying mechanisms of creating promises in V8 itself. So we can actually remove like one promise and a couple stack frames by doing it this way. So if you use our util promisify function to turn your callback APIs into promise-based APIs, it will be more efficient than if you just wrapped it in a promise. Mm. But people can also just write promise-based APIs. There's lots of different ways to do it. To your original question of why that matters, really it comes down to what API surface you want to do and what language features you want available.
Awesome. I'm actually quite interested in Cloud Functions. So I'm hoping that we can actually sit down together and hash out some Cloud Functions for gaming.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome.
I think for gaming too, depending on what you're doing, there's a lot of interesting uses for Cloud Functions in general. And I think it would be cool to get down and kind of like similar to what I was talking about, where there isn't a huge difference between functions and apps and containers. There are subtle differences. So figuring out those subtle differences tend to be like how you can figure out which of those shapes is the most appropriate for the problem space you're solving.
Sweet. Before we run away today, is there anything special that you want to plug? Are you going anywhere? Are you announcing anything? Mm. Anything you haven't covered today that you want to make sure we mention before we finish up?
Yeah, well, I mean, the merger, we're hoping to land officially and legally March 11th at the Open Source Leadership Summit, fingers crossed. Mm-hmm. I would encourage people, hey, you know, there's like a whole bunch of organizations that you can volunteer for or donate to help people get into technology who are from traditionally marginalized or underrepresented groups. So groups like Black Girls Code or Scripted or Girls Who Code. There's a list. We should come up with a bunch and put it at the end of this podcast.
Sweet.
But I, for one, love to spend my time doing lots of different things. It is not that hard to just squeeze in a little bit of time to volunteer for these organizations or squeeze out a little bit of money to help support them. You know, the world's not going to change by themselves. So, you know, put some time in.
This is great because I actually teach to a program that kind of functions in the same fashion, targeting, you know, those marginalized and underrepresented groups. So this is definitely an awesome thing to hear.
Awesome. Well, Miles, thank you so much for joining us today and telling us all about Node.js and all the fun things.
Thank you for having me. This is a lot of fun. Hopefully we can do it again sometime. Yeah, maybe 2021, I'll pencil it in.
Always a pleasure.
So thanks, Miles, for joining us. And hopefully we'll hear from you in the near future on the many cool things you're doing.
Yeah, always a pleasure to talk to Miles. Getting stuck into our question of the week, though, I get to ask you tough questions, which is fun, too. I hear you've been having lots of fun connecting Google Cloud APIs to work within the Unity game engine. I think that's not as easy as it sounds. How have you managed to get this to work?
So recently, I've been using a lot of PubSub and Translate. And in order to get those APIs working, what you actually have to do is, if you're using Visual Studio as your editor for Unity, what you do is you download the NuGet package, and it'll download a series of libraries on your computer, and you would actually have to locate those files and move them over to a plugin folder in your Unity Projects root folder. Once you do that, you have to create this link.xml file that actually loads all these references on startup, because just downloading the NuGet packages won't really help you, because Unity looks for those dependencies and those references and all those assemblies that you need to load up every single time that you start Unity. And if your project cannot have a file that points to those, then it won't start up. So that's a great option to help you get started.
Sweet. And that's the NuGet package for the Google Cloud libraries?
Yes. You can use any NuGet package that has a supported C# client library.
Oh, nice. Very, very cool. Oh, that's a great tip. Before we wrap up today, John, where are you going? Doing anything fun and exciting in the near future?
Yeah, so I'll be at GDC next month. I'll be at Cloud Next in 2 months. I'll be at ECGC, which will be really fun. And I will also be at Vector 2019.
Oh, very nice. I like Vector. It's a shame that I won't be there this year. Yeah, so I think we're going to be at the same places. I will also be at GDC, presenting on Agones and doing all sorts of good stuff too. Come check out the Google booth. We're part of that. Cloud Next will be there as well. Just got told that we will have a space on the show floor for the podcast. So if you're coming to Cloud Next, definitely swing by and say hello. And I'll also be at East Coast Games Conference presenting as well. Awesome. Well, John, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, and I can't wait to join many, many episodes in the future.
Excellent. And thank you all for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
Awesome.